You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. With all the stresses of life, it can be easy to lose perspective on what really matters. But Heineken believes that life is about being with friends and opening yourself to new experiences. Because when you live spontaneously and embrace the unexpected, it's a chance to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today. With its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers. And now, enjoy the podcast. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Major Garrett has been reporting on the White House for nearly 2 decades, covering 4 different presidencies for 3 different news outlets. When he covered the Obama White House for Fox News, he was often called into Press Secretary Robert Gibbs's office for an impromptu tongue-lashing about Fox's coverage of President Obama, and now Major Garrett on more than one occasion has found himself on the wrong side of a new president and his deadly Twitter feed. But if he thought that his distinguished journalistic career had prepared him for the unique challenges of covering Donald Trump, he was in for a surprise. Like many others in Washington, Garrett has found himself having to unlearn many of his own settled notions about the nature and function of the presidency and separate the carnival-like noise of the Trump presidency from its underlying substance. He writes about the experience in a new book titled Mr. Trump's Wild Ride, The Thrills, Chills, Screams, and Occasional Blackouts of an Extraordinary Presidency. And today, Major Garrett joins me on the podcast to talk about his strange first encounter with the man who would become president and the craziest 11 days he's ever experienced covering the White House. He discusses the many ways in which the president is his own worst enemy, how the president's failure at health care reform led to his success on tax reform, and when it was all said and done, the president learned absolutely nothing. He shares some of the reasons why many Republicans have said no thanks to a job in the Trump administration, why the Brett Kavanaugh confirmation is a must-win for Donald Trump, and why he believes we're witnessing a transformative presidency, the effects of which, for better or worse, could last for generations. Coming up with CBS News White House correspondent Major Garrett in just a moment. Major Garrett has been a fixture in executive branch reporting for 17 years, serving as a White House correspondent for 3 news outlets during the last 4 administrations. He's been CBS News chief White House correspondent since 2012 and is a substitute anchor of Face the Nation. Now Major has written about his experience covering the Trump administration in a new book titled Mr. Trump's Wild Ride, The Thrills, Chills, Screams, and Occasional Blackouts of an Extraordinary Presidency. Major Garrett, thanks for joining me.
Great to be with you. Thank you for the time.
Well, Major, this is not typically the kind of book that an active White House correspondent writes about a sitting president, especially one with a vindictive streak like Donald Trump. Weren't you worried they might pull your press credentials?
Not at all. This is a journalistic book. It's tough on the president where the facts lead to tough conclusions and appraisals of what he actually did. what he actually said or those speaking on his behalf said and how those statements or actions comport with the facts or intentions. So in that sense, it's journalistic and tough and curious, and there is an accountability component to it as well. But there's also a substantial amount of real estate devoted to the book about things that have already happened during the Trump administration. The White House calls them accomplishments. Some Americans don't uniformly regard them as such, but what I argue in the book is there is a lot that comes at the country with the Trump presidency. There is a frenetic pace. There is an improvisational quality. There are jarring aspects. There is anxiety. But that doesn't mean things haven't happened that 5, 10, possibly even 20 years from now, historians and others are not going to look back on and say, these are consequential actions that we are still living with. Mm-hmm. So what I try to do is begin to draft out what is already, based on my experience covering four previous presidents, the early essences of a Trump legacy.
Indeed, you say in the book that President Trump is transforming the presidency and the country, presumably for the worse. Where do you think he's leaving a lasting mark?
Well, let's just take a couple of large-scale issues. There is the already confirmed Supreme Court justice. There is a dramatic story playing out this week in Washington about the second Trump Supreme Court nominee. If there are two confirmed, or there is a huge clash over this attempt to confirm Brett Kavanaugh and another one, still two Supreme Court justices in a first term would be a large and significant mark left by any president, certainly by President Trump, if that's what happens. If you look at the appellate court justices confirmed in the first year, 12, and then nearly that many already in the second year, that's a substantial alteration of the appellate courts and the federal bench. That's big. The tax cut, whether you like it or hate it, is going to be a big part of the American economy, corporate taxation, individual taxation, and small business taxation for the next 5 to 10 years, possibly longer. And if you look at what I consider one of the most significant yet undercovered stories of the Trump presidency, it's what's happened in the regulation sphere of the federal government. I argue in the book that President Trump is the most aggressive deregulatory president since Ronald Reagan, and more successful in a shorter period of time if you consider repealing regulations a success. Not all Americans do, but if you do, more successful in a shorter period of time than Ronald Reagan. The country will be living with those regulations that no longer exist, and the orientation to future regulatory actions that this administration has completely blunted. Yeah. Just taking those three are significant, but we'll just add one more. Immigration, enforcing it to the hilt and changing the entire global perspective on America, on the question of what is its orientation, both in conversation and in law, to immigration. Whether you love those changes or hate them, they're pretty sizable.
And with regard to deregulation, from where I stand, I'll be honest with you, Major, I don't know if deregulation is a deliberate priority for President Trump or if it's just a byproduct of the systemic dysfunction he's created and simply a matter that nobody's minding the store in so many cases. What do you think?
Oh, I think there is something systematic about it. Certainly, and I outline this in the book, and I have an entire chapter devoted to deregulation. Not the sexiest of topics for a journalist or historian or political scientist to attempt to tackle, but I thought it was important enough that it required a chapter to at least discuss and begin to scratch the surface of it. I think the administration, certainly working with Congress, using the Congressional Review Act to go at Obama-era regulations from the last year of the Obama presidency to systematically erase them from the federal code was intentional in every stretch of the imagination. And those people placed in various agencies have been empowered and ordered and directed by the president, not just in rhetoric, but in executive memoranda, to look for Obama-era or earlier regulations. And if they can find the means and understand how to write the proper memos or instructions to get rid of them. You've seen that at the EPA. You've seen that at the Interior Department, to name just two. But it's also happened at Health and Human Services. Some changes to the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare, that could not be carried out legislatively. They have sought the refuge of regulatory actions or inactions or recalibrations or redescriptions of things that had been existing as something that was carried out by Health and Human Services. So I do think this is more systematic, almost the most systematic effort undertaken by this presidency when it comes to changing things from the way they found them upon arrival.
Now, I want to go back to the Supreme Court for a moment. You say under Donald Trump, we are witnessing the Scaliaification of the judiciary.
Those are his words, not mine. Yeah, those are his words.
Right, and I want to ask you about his current Supreme Court nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. Who knows what might happen by the time this airs next week, but for now, it's looking pretty dicey for Judge Kavanaugh. Now that there's a second accuser who's come forth with sexual assault allegations against Brett Kavanaugh, one might think that with the Me Too movement and everything, why not cut your losses and start fresh with a new nominee? But do you think the president's stubborn streak might overrule rational strategy and maybe he even sees this as another opportunity to stick it to the establishment?
Well, that's certainly part of it. Every opportunity the president can find to stick it to the establishment or what he regards as a sort of cabal of critics of either his administration, his Supreme Court nominees in the case of Brett Kavanaugh, or other things he's tried to accomplish, that will to stick it to them is pronounced. But I would say there is something that the White House would regard as rational about sticking with Brett Kavanaugh and sticking with a process that no matter how many fits and starts and no matter how much short-term political damage is incurred or suffered, getting a second Supreme Court nominee on the bench before the midterm elections, if at all possible, is something close to an imperative, because the reach of a sitting Supreme Court justice, especially one who replaces Anthony Kennedy, could be significant, and significant in terms of the president's own approach to reelection. Mm-hmm. So I think when they ask themselves, is this a rational strategy? The White House knows these are already turbulent midterm political waters.
Mm-hmm.
Kavanaugh has made them a little bit more so. But they ask themselves, are they really going to get any calmer if we pull this nomination? Not in the slightest.
Yeah.
And if we pull it, how much more of a heavy lift will the beginning of that process all over again be? And into what kind of Senate majority or minority might that nominee land? I think the impetus right now, and I use those words guardedly because things shift dramatically inside the Trump White House on a dime. But right now, the impetus appears to be lock arms. If you can find the votes, get them, confirm Kavanaugh, despite all of the potential short-term political risk.
Well, Major, I want to take a minute to go back to the election. Prior to that moment, I suppose that there was no particular reason why you and Donald Trump's paths would have crossed. So when did you first have a direct encounter with him?
Early August of 2015 in Birch Run, Michigan.
Okay.
It was after the first debate, the one in Cleveland, and it was clear to us that the Trump phenomenon was something we needed to start paying attention to. And after that first debate and some of the public reaction to it, both positive and negative, it was clear he was to use a cliche, a lightning rod already. And we needed to take a look at that up close. So I traveled out to Birch Run, Michigan. It wasn't even a Trump campaign rally. It was a joint fundraiser for two Republican county parties in that part of Michigan. I still have my press badge. It doesn't say Trump on it at all. It has Genesee County and one other county, which I've forgotten the name of. As a fundraiser, you pay $25 to get in and I think $75 to get a close-up seat. So it was a fundraiser. And Trump was there, and he was, of course, the only act. And he had a press conference before the rally speech and presentation. He happened to catch my eye after answering a couple of questions, and the first word out of his mouth were, "Major, fantastic, you're here." What did that mean? It meant he had a network correspondent, which he hadn't seen in the audience before. What did that mean? It means he was rising. What did that mean? He was succeeding. Much of Trump's worldview is first and foremost viewed through the prism of how he's doing. And as much as he scorns the press, as much as he turns the venom of his supporters against a free press, there is a part of President Trump's psychology that is, if not addicted, deeply dependent upon the media, its coverage, and how he finds himself within that vortex of coverage. And I opened the book by explaining in that there were a few more words that Trump spoke to me. It's an entire sentence and a couple of thoughts in there. And I take myself to task for not paying closer attention because Trump gave me a roadmap to himself and to my future interactions with him, that if I had paid closer attention, if I had paid more heed to the central truth about Trump, which is 90% of it is hanging out there every single day. There are very few deep hid schemes or buffed up rhetoric with Trump. He comes at you like a sledgehammer. And once you begin to study that, you can learn a lot more about him. I didn't study that nearly as clearly as I should have for a long time, and I suffered because of it.
And I recall in that same brief encounter with then-candidate Trump, he went from praising you to berating you and insulting you to being friends again, and I think even saying, let's do lunch. Your experience gives just a window into the mercurial nature of this president. Looking over the past 2 years, so much of the larger dysfunction and chaos in the White House comes right from the guy at the top. I can't remember a president who trolled his own allies in Congress and even his own cabinet secretaries like
this.
No,
I can't either. I don't think there's anything in recorded American history for the presidency that's like it. I mean, there are parts of Andrew Jackson's presidency that caused a similar sense of unease in official Washington, but they don't really compare with the president. And one thing I write about in the book that is reflective of what you just talked about and some of these other themes about how does Trump go about what he does and why. I can't give you a unified theory as to why Donald Trump does what he does. But what I do believe and what I write about in the book is that he never stops testing anyone, except his family. Outside of his family, if you work for him and around him, you are relentlessly tested. That means you're trolled. That means you're criticized. That means you're praised. That means you are run up and down the flagpole of emotions constantly. And you are never absolutely sure where you stand with him. He likes to impose that variable upon your life, even if it means your already difficult job is made that much more difficult. That is a very hard thing to experience in politics. Very hard.
But does he not seem to understand that in many ways, he's only shooting himself in the foot and undermining his own agenda that way?
I write in the book, he does not understand that. I say that clearly and unapologetically. I say oftentimes the worst enemy of President Trump when it comes to his agenda and a White House that operates with a sense of common purpose in pursuit of that agenda, the biggest enemy is not the media, it's not the Democratic obstructionists, quote unquote. It's the president's own turbulent, improvisational, and hard-to-predict personality, temper, and sense of constantly leaving people in limbo as to where they stand with him and where an agenda item stands in terms of his priorities, even if he has already said things that they believe are certain about his intentions or his purpose.
And a good example of this is his failed attempt at repeal and replace, but you suggest in the book that there's a direct line from his failure on health care to his success on tax reform. Explain the cause and effect there.
Yeah, it's not that there was a systematic sort of, well, we didn't have a machine that worked for Obamacare, and now we know how to build the machine that will work to pass tax cuts. But there were things learned that contributed. But some of the things didn't have to be learned. Let's just be very clear about this. After the repeal and replace effort of the Affordable Care Act failed, Republicans started hearing from their donors, their big donors, in very large numbers and in very angry voices. You guys aren't doing anything. The big agenda items are lagging. Yes, there's been some action on deregulation, but you're now 0-for-1. And it's getting nearer the end of the year, and you're going to be reaching a crisis point if you don't perform. So the sense of absolute imperative around taxes focused Congress. It focused the White House, Gary Cohn specifically, who ran all the meetings on behalf of the White House. And I write in pretty vivid detail how it did, for a time being, focus the president, focused his Twitter feed, focused his rhetoric, focused his phone calls, focused his lobbying efforts, which were fundamentally different from the way he approached repealing and replacing Obamacare. For that, he didn't care about the policy, didn't really understand it, wasn't really interested in it, just wanted a deal, any deal. Taxes, he knew the specifics more clearly, was more conversant and familiar with them, knew what he wanted to achieve, and drove a very hard bargain, but also remained very disciplined about how to approach it. And so those things all sort of came together to create passage of the tax reform and tax cuts. And then I say after that, did they learn enough to apply this elsewhere? Absolutely not.
We're going to take a quick break, and then I'll be back with more with CBS White House correspondent Major Garrett when we come back in just a moment. Life can be stressful, and sometimes we lose perspective on what really matters. As we rush to achieve all the things we want in life, it can be easy to forget to enjoy the smaller moments along the way. But life isn't about following a common path or having a set plan. It's about being with friends, celebrating with loved ones, and living in the moment. Heineken believes that you create the richest memories when you embrace the unexpected and open yourself to new experiences. That's why Heineken encourages everyone to live spontaneously. Because when you embrace the unexpected, things like exploring new parties, enjoying the summertime, watching exciting soccer matches, and celebrating the holidays with your family, all become chances to create new stories and connections. You just have to open it up. So enjoy a refreshingly cold, full-bodied Heineken Lager today, with its deep golden color, light fruity aroma, mild bitter taste, and a crisp, clean finish. Cheers! Folks, I'm so happy to have Bombas as a new sponsor of the podcast because I'm a huge sock guy. I know that sounds weird, but it's true. Everyone who's been on the show knows I always have some funky socks on my feet. Not funky as in smelly, but funky as in fun colors, whimsical, fashion-forward, but also functional and comfortable. And as a sock connoisseur, let me say that nobody makes a better sock than Bombas. Thanks to 2 years of research and development and multiple improvements in design, performance, and comfort, Bombas are the most comfortable socks in the history of feet. With an arch support system that provides extra support where you need it most and a cushioned footbed that's reinforced for comfort without added bulkiness, Bombas feel like a hug around your foot. Not to mention, Bombas Stay Up technology ensures that your socks stay in place without leaving a mark. And the super soft cotton material makes you never want to take them off. So whether you're a runner, power walker, or power lounger, that's me, there's a pair of Bombas that'll add comfort to your life. As a matter of fact, I'm wearing a pair of purple Bombas Marl's calf-length socks even as we speak. They come in every color of the rainbow, and I ordered them all because they look great and they're easily the most comfortable socks I've ever owned. There's a good reason. These socks are scientifically engineered for comfort. Think about that. How much time do you spend trying to find a comfortable pair of shoes? Now ask yourself how much thought you've ever given to your socks. Socks go on your feet too, folks, and if you're suffering from tired feet, consider this. Maybe you've got the right shoes, but the wrong socks. You owe it to your feet to find out what a perfectly engineered sock feels like. Take it from me, they're a game changer. Go to bombas.com/kick and use the code KICK for 20% off your first order. That's Bombas, bombas.com/kick, code KICK, and you'll get 20% off your first order. And now, back to the podcast. What I find hard to understand is he did this victory lap on tax reform and promptly reverted back to the same dysfunction that killed health care. So why didn't Donald Trump and his staff learn from that experience with the tax bill and try to replicate that success by taking a more disciplined approach to other priorities?
Well, in part because anything else outside of health care and taxes requires some Democratic support because you can't run them through the system with only 51 votes in the Senate, which he could do with taxes, and he tried to do and came a vote short on health care. But everything else requires bipartisanship. And there have been a couple of areas, veterans, affairs, healthcare reforms, and some things on opioid addictions where they've actually worked through the system. Congress has worked in a bipartisan way, and there have been some not significant but important achievements there. But they, of course, are completely lost by all the other things that are, as I write in the book, part of the weekly cyclonic spasms of the Trump White House and Trump administration.
It's gotten so bad that there are a lot of staff positions still unfilled, and we've seen an unusually high turnover rate this early in a presidency. What is the thinking of the people you've talked to who either quit or said no thanks to a gig in this White House?
Well, for those who have said no thanks, they can't bear Trump, and they can't bear to associate themselves with him. And that's interesting in of itself. Working for a White House, whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, is the pinnacle of your political career, bar none, no matter what your job is. And the higher up you go, the more exalted it is, and the more of a permanent part of your resume it becomes. There is now a reputational risk. There was almost from the very beginning in the minds of some Republicans about working for the Trump administration. So that's one component. For those who worked there and quit, they wanted him to succeed. They wanted to do their best, but they found it exhausting, taxing, traumatizing, and something they just simply could not bear. They could not keep up with it, and so they had to find refuge elsewhere. For those who are still there, there is, and I write about this in some detail in the book, a constant conversation that goes on that runs something like this. Why am I here? What am I doing? Who am I serving? Is this my kind of president? In some cases, the answer is yes. In some cases, the answer is no. But oftentimes, the most important aspect of answering that question is, this is the verdict of the public. This is the way the Electoral College shook out. This is what the country asked for. And on behalf of that and the Constitution that adheres a country and its vote to the presidency and the actions thereof, I'm here to work. But it's a tough question. It's an existential question. And I say in the book, these kinds of questions are not typically asked at the deep level of emotion and sort of purpose when you work for a president. Usually they're second nature. Usually they're, of course I'm here. Of course I'm here serving. This is the greatest thing that's ever happened to me. Those conversations are very few and far between. There's so much else that comes with working for President Trump.
Well, I have to ask about the effects of the anonymous New York Times op-ed in the Woodward book. Have those events changed the dynamic between the White House and the press? And are you seeing a higher level of paranoia than before?
No, I don't think so. No. And as far as the paranoia, I write in the book that it's never been far away. Mm-hmm. One of the things I think is different in the second year of the Trump presidency is you have fewer of the intense cross West Wing firefights than you used to when Steve Bannon was there and Gary Cohn was there.
Right.
And Jared and Ivanka were trying to figure out the best way to claim and hold their territory. And Kellyanne Conway was looking for her space. And Reince Priebus was trying to protect his. I say at one point in the book, there was a kind of a relentless crossfire. And on any given day back in that first year, five or six people walked into the West Wing each day thinking they were the chief of staff, functionally. Well, that made for some very tough rivalries, some very tough intramural clashes. John Kelly has quieted a lot of that, but the op-ed sort of raised again this notion that whether it's a coping mechanism, whether it's guardrails, there are lots of different metaphors people use who still work with the administration to try to take the president's formidable energy and focus and harness it as best they can and minimize the things that he spouts off about or yells about or just spitballs about that to some sound terrifying and meaningful but really are nothing more than ideas cast about in search of maybe some better idea. There's a lot of coping, managing, guardrail building, and let's say buffering of what is said by the president within the West Wing. And look, I'm not there. I don't have listening devices, but I've talked to enough people who have either been there or are still there to get a very strong impression that what I'm describing is not inaccurate.
In a chapter titled 11 Days in May, you recall the infamous Comey firing and the fallout from the perspective of the White House press corps. Were you guys just in sheer disbelief? How did you react to that news?
Well, yes, we were. That firing landed like a thunderbolt. I write in the book that it was as if the ground opened up and every foundation around the White House began to shake. And it felt that way. And if that had been the only story for the next 10 days, that would have been enough. The firing of an FBI director who was overseeing an investigation into a malevolent foreign nation possibly meddling and or interfering in a just concluded presidential election. I think you and I would agree that would be enough for 10 days, but it was only a fraction of what was to come. Let's just trip through memory lane quickly. There was the Comey firing, then the conflicting explanations from the White House, then the president telling NBC Russia investigation had something to do with it. Then there was a meeting in the Oval Office with two top Russian officials, foreign minister and the top ambassador of the United States. they're yucking it up. In that meeting, Trump says something about firing Comey, calls him a nut job, says he's in the clear now, or some words to that effect. Then there's a story about him possibly leaking classified information. Maybe it was just sensitive, but maybe he shouldn't have been talking about it under any account. Then forceful denials from the White House. Oh, then it was Israel's intelligence. Did that get us off track with a longstanding ally? Oh, then there was a North Korean missile launch, ballistic missile launch, and a North Korean hack. Then the president says something about possibly having tapes on James Comey. I'm only about 7 days in the 10 days in May, and I've already out of breath. And I was back then. Completely out of breath. The sense that all this was coming at us with such tremendous velocity, such tremendous importance, and so different than anything we had seen coming and being described about the inner workings of a White House. When I think back on those days, I'm literally amazed I got through them, just because it felt so helter-skelter, so uneven, and I write in the book, physically exhausting and emotionally traumatizing.
So, Major, if this is a transformative presidency, as you suggest, do we just snap back from this once he's out of office 2 years or 6 years from now? Or do you think he's redefining the office in ways that will echo through successive presidencies?
Well, one thing, the place I use the word transformative is about the tax bill, because I do think that fundamentally changes the tax code, which is going to change revenue coming to the federal government. It's going to change the way our businesses operate and our individuals view their own incomes. That's transformational. I'm not saying the presidency itself at this point is transformational, but the presidency of Donald Trump has set in motion many, many things. And the core question you just asked me is, where are we going to be? What is going to be the after effect? Is this going to look like something that's rebuilt, something that's destroyed, something that's smoldering ruins, or something that is just different in kind but better and stronger? And let me tell you, you lay that question before Trump supporters and opponents of the president, you will get deeply emotional, highly specific answers. I can't answer that in totality. But one thing I can say with absolute clarity, this presidency has reanimated a conversation in our country about institutions, not just the Fourth Estate, not just the press corps, but the courts, the Congress, state legislatures. What are our institutional bulwarks? How do they function? Who populates them? What do they mean to us? How strong are they? How strong should they be? Can we deal with what we are seeing? These are the kinds of questions we haven't really asked ourselves since the second term of Richard Nixon's presidency. And I'm not suggesting that impeachment or anything of that kind is in the offing. It very well might be. I don't know. What I do know is, long before that's even begun, if it is to begin, we've been asking these kinds of questions about what is our republic made of, what are our institutions made of, how strong are they, and what are we doing either to fortify them or to change them to reflect this new president, because Trump supporters think some things need to be changed and pretty big, and they wanted him to knock things over. So what I'm certain of is we're having a very different kind of conversation in this country about those institutions. And the only reason we are having them is because Donald Trump is the president.
Well, I know that you have to go, Major. Real quickly, has Sarah Huckabee taken you in her office and read you the Riot Act over this book yet?
No, she asked for a copy 3 days before its release. I was kind enough to bring it to her, and never heard a discouraging word.
Wow!
And one of the things you'll notice in the book, it's all on the record. Everybody's quoted, and no one has screamed or yelled or even whispered that there's anything inaccurate or out of context. I'm proud of that.
Well, again, the book is called Mr. Trump's Wild Ride: The Thrills, Chills, Screams, and Occasional Blackouts of an Extraordinary Presidency. Major Garrett, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks. I appreciate it very much.
Thanks again to Major Garrett for coming on the podcast. Order his book, Mr. Trump's Wild Ride: The Thrills, Chills, Screams, and Occasional Blackouts of an Extraordinary Presidency, on Amazon, Audible, or your local bookstore. See Major Garrett regularly reporting from the White House on CBS News. Subscribe to his podcast, The Takeout, on Apple Podcasts or wherever you like to listen. And follow him on Twitter at @MajorCBS. You deserve a better email marketing platform. And unlike other email providers, Emma puts its customers first. It's powerful email marketing with a personal touch. Their award-winning team is always ready to support you on your email marketing strategy, design, list migration, and more, so you'll have everything you need to do your best email marketing yet. Request a customized demo of Emma's email marketing platform today at myemma.com. Again, that's myemma.com. If you haven't already, be sure to subscribe to Kick-Ass News on iTunes and leave us a review. You can follow us on Facebook or on Twitter at @KickAssNewsPod. And as always, I welcome your comments, questions, and ideas at comments@kickassnews.com. I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News. Kick-Ass News is a trademark of Mathis Entertainment, Inc.